You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter. And I get to say it's a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It's cool, but it's sunny.
It is sunny, gorgeous, no rain whatsoever on the horizon. We've had a good 3.5 inches already back in November. Lois and I are preparing this show on December 4, 2024 for broadcast on December 5. And the temperature this morning as we speak to each other is 50 degrees, going up to a high today of 61 and sunny. There was a dense fog advisory this morning, and it was appropriate. There were areas of dense fog out here in Solano County. Tonight will be 40 degrees with patchy fog, becoming Sunday the day of the broadcast. Thursday and 61. Thursday night, another fog alert, 38 degrees. Friday, 60 degrees and sunny. Friday night, patchy fog and 39 degrees. Saturday, patchy fog, then partly sunny. Going to take longer to clear off on Saturday with a high of only 57 degrees on Saturday. Saturday night, 40 degrees, patchy fog and partly cloudy. Sunday, sunny, high near 55. Sunday night, clear, 41. Could get colder than that if it's clear. Monday, sunny with a high near 53. Monday night, mostly clear, 37. We've got very little change in the horizon. The extended discussion Sunday through Wednesday at the National Weather Service, upper ridging, ridging means sunny or foggy, builds inland Sunday into Monday with some gusty north to east wind on Sunday and Monday. Pressure gradients relax Tuesday morning, so the wind will go away, then tighten again over the northern and eastern foothills and mountains Tuesday night into Wednesday. The model is advertising, they say here, some precipitation chances over the northern portions of the forecast area on Wednesday. Northern portions means north end of the Sacramento Valley. And the confidence is low with this as the models maintain the upper ridging in some other cases. So basically, what you see today is what we're going to have for a week. How's that? Fairly cold nights, foggy. Could be frosty. We've had a fair bit of frost already and days in the mid-50s to 60s. A great time to plant some of those winter vegetables and flowers. But, you know, it is our fundraising week here, our fall fundraiser here at KDRT. So the first order of business is we want to talk about that. We're in the middle of our big fall fundraiser. If you enjoy the Davis Garden Show, if you like the other great programming here at KDRT, if you just like the idea of publicly supported community radio, we'd appreciate it if you would take a moment, head over to kdrt.org/donate. That's kdrt.org/donate this week and contribute at whatever level you're comfortable with. It's easy. You'll find a range of choices there, different support levels, an option for recurring donations. We love those. Some great thank you gifts and more. That's kdrt.org/donate. Thanks for your support. And as always, thanks for listening to KDRT.
And not only are we asking for your support, but we're giving you opportunities to come and have fun with us. So as part of KDRT's 20th anniversary celebration, we'll be visiting with our neighbors at the Davis Manor Holiday Crafts Bazaar. Please come and join us for arts and crafts, snacks, live music from legendary guitarist Dave Nachmanoff, and more. And it'll all be at the corner of Duke Street and M Street here in Davis, California, on Sunday, December 8th. Drop in. It's open from 11 till 2. Now, wait a minute. I had another one here. Let me see.
Yeah, there's all kinds of events around the area where KDRT programmers will be hanging out and chatting, and come say hi.
Well, this next one is really specific to the music DJs around here. It is Help Cater Celebrate 20 Years on the Air at a special holiday vinyl bazaar with music from the 410s. I don't know them. At Blue Note Brewing in Woodland. It's Sunday, December 8th from noon to 5 p.m. So join KDRT friends at Blue Note Brewing.
Okay. This goes on all week. If you didn't happen to donate on Giving Tuesday, well, you can still go over to kdrt.org/donate and give a contribution. We appreciate your donations at any level. We also love your questions and comments, and want to say hi to Morgan out there who stopped by my nursery to say hi. Big fan of the show. I always love it when folks do that. And if you have questions and you want to get on the air, just send them to davisgardenshow@gmail.com, which several people have done. But I'll tell you what the most common question is I'm getting right now. Is it really okay to plant these?
Well, that has to do with what it is you're going to plant. Tomatoes? No, it's no,
too, not, right. too cold for tomatoes. We'll come back to them in March. But yes, I actually have a rule at my garden center, and I wish more would run them this way. If we have it, it's an appropriate time to, it is an appropriate time to plant them, and we don't have things that are not appropriate for planting. But it's a reasonable question. You know, you go into some places and there's still vegetables kind of hanging around, and you wonder, oh, it's December, we're getting frost in the morning. Is it really okay to put in broccoli right now? The things that you see in the broccoli family, the lettuce family, all that group are suitable for planting now. Frost will not harm them. Yes, you need to water them to get them started. But typically, a cool thing about planting at this time of year, water once, check them every day, you know, especially if the north wind blows. But most of these things don't even need water daily. Things I put in a week ago, I'm going to go ahead and water today. Now, a week ago, it was raining, but we got a lot of rain and the soil has very good hydration at this point. Check daily. Water is needed, but that's much less critical in December than it is in June. So if you see it in a nursery and they run well, it is a good time to plant them. In fact, let's talk a little bit about things you can plant now.
Well, before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about freezes and frosts and that sort of stuff. Yeah. Now, I know that you keep track of lots of information and have done since the 80s. Yep. What would you like to tell our listeners about frosts and freezes? Things below 32, I think, would be a good thing.
Yeah, and bear in mind, this is Davis. Davis is Sunset Zone 14, USDA Zone 9. I would say 9B would be where Davis would fall, not USDA Zone 10 yet, because we still get plenty of frost. And that's a question that keeps coming up. You know, as last winter was warm, we had plenty of chilling hours and frost in December. And then in January, it warmed up. New Year's Day was 60 degrees. The foxes on my property spent the entire day basking in the sun on my deck, which isn't something you normally see on New Year's Day around here. But we do get frost every winter. I use first of all, the site I go to, I've mentioned many times before, is the CIMIS Weather Station, CIMIS, run by the Water Resources Department in the state. And they automatically track temperatures. Now, I don't say that every day that was 32 or below, you could see a visible frost, but it's a good marker. And by the way, you can have frost even when it's 34, 35, 36 degrees. As your weather station temperature, you can still see frost on surfaces that lose heat to the sky, like the top of your car, grass blade, leaf blades of grass, and so forth. But I figured 32 degrees or lower is a good, pretty definitely you had a frost that night. We get about, on average, going back to 1990, we have an average of about 20 times per winter in Davis that you get 32 degrees or lower. However, that included one rather anomalous year. This is something
that would be 1990 when it was below freezing for 10 days straight.
Yes, and that happened a couple other times during that period. But that was that year we recorded 42 days that winter. The winter I'm using October 1 through February 28th, or actually through March. We do get occasional frost March and even April, according to my records. But that year we had 42 days of frost, and 10 days of that was not just frost, a major freeze event in Northern California, Central California, even down into Southern California. So if we take that 42 days one out of the average, it's 10 to 15 days below 30, where we get below 32 nights, I should say, where we get below 32 degrees, where there was probably a frost. Last winter, we only had 5. The winter before, we had 13. Before that, we had 7. Before that, we had 10. Way back in the 90s, we had 3 years in a row where it was 8, 3, and 8. And then the next year was 27 days, 32 or below. So you could look at this and see that the incidence of 32 degrees and below appears to be declining. However, the strongest correlation that I see is with the Southern Oscillation, which is the fancy term for El Nino and La Nina. El Nino years, we tend to have strong El Nino years. We tend to have a lot of rain. We have a lot of rain. We tend not to have much frost because all that moisture, all that water keeps it from happening. When we have dry years, La Nina, strong La Nina years tend to be drought years. We tend to have more frost episodes simply because there's more nights with clear skies. So that's the pattern that I've certainly seen. We're going into a La Nina year. We're not there yet, interestingly. And it appears to be a weak one, which are the least predictable. But in terms of the number of frosts, how many do we typically get? 10 or 15? And every now and then, about every 7 or 8 years, we still get a significantly cold event. We had one in 2017 where we had 18 days of frost, but we had here on my farm, we got down to 21 degrees a couple times during that particular cold event that year, January 2018. Did some damage to young citrus, didn't do as much damage in town, but about every few years, we still get these regional freeze events. Long ago, when I would write articles about this, I would try to distinguish between a frost and a freeze. And the National Weather Service would do so as well. I think we talked about this last week. But to me, a freeze is a big cold air mass that moves in, settles in an area, affects a wide region, and goes below our average temperatures substantially, not just a cold night. It's not just even a series of cold nights. That's a frost. Those are fine. It's the regional freeze events that we've had 1990, 1998, 2006, 2013, 2017, we've gotten cold enough during freeze events in those winters to damage some plants that people care about. Particularly citrus is the usual topic of conversation, but bougainvilleas and other plants that are a little out of their climate range. All those other things are just a frost, 32, 31, 30 degrees. As we point out, plants can go down, unless they're truly tropical, plants can go down to 30 or even 29 degrees without significant injury. It'll damage the tender new growth on some plants if they're putting on tender new growth late in the season, but it doesn't really harm even the semi-hardwood, much less the hardwood of the plant. It's the freeze events that we're concerned about. But yes, we do get frost, and we get a dozen or so a year. It would be an easy summary of what I just said. How's that?
That's a good summary. And I'm taking away from that that you say, oh, well, the tender tips might be. Well, yeah. But there's lots of plants that are just fine in the winter and are not going to have their tender little dips hurt by a little frost.
Yeah, again, 90% of the questions we get are about citrus. And part of that is that citrus almost always flush growth late in the summer. They're subtropical. They start growing, actually, April, May, typically. You get a couple feet of growth, and they'll continue to put on surges of new growth, especially if you have them on a high nitrogen feeding schedule. So September, October, a big flush of growth will come out. A bunch of my mandarins did that. Yeah, I'm going out and looking at that, and it's not even being harmed by the kind of frost we're having now, but they're curling a bit because of the temperature. They're curling more because of the north wind that we had a few days ago, and they'll be fine. They may look a little disfigured, but it doesn't really hurt them. In the range of citrus, it's a huge group of plants, and there are citrus that are completely cold hardy, like yuzu, kumquats, Satsuma mandarins can go down to 21 degrees with no problem. And then there are many others that are on the tender end of the spectrum, generally the limes and some of the lemons. So they might need a little more protection when they're young. But for the most part, citrus here in USDA Zone 9B or 9A, Sunset Zone 14, will go through the winter just fine. There are a couple that I don't recommend because they won't. Mexican lime being a good example. And as people migrate to try and plant more avocados, this has become a very complicated subject because you see Guatemalan avocados, which in my professional opinion are too tender to grow here, at practically every one of the hardware chains that sell fruit trees. So you go into Home Depot or Lowe's or Tractor Supply, and they'll have avocados out there in the spring, and they're almost always Guatemalan avocados because that's what the public wants. They want to grow the Haas avocado. Go for it. Find a microclimate around your house. Don't buy it from me, because I'll tell you that I'm not going to sell you a Guatemalan avocado because I think they're too tender to grow here. If you are absolutely fixed on growing one, look around for one of the dwarf types, like Little Cado or Gwyn, or there's a couple others. And you can keep that in a tub, in a big barrel, and keep it close to your house, or plant it in the ground next to the house and be prepared to cover that plant. And you might get some avocados 5, 6, 7 years from now. Actually how long it takes usually. So this is a long-term project you're taking on. And then we'll have one of those 7 or 8 year events, and your avocado will probably be toast unless you go to specific efforts to protect it. Mexican avocados, by comparison, are hardy here. Enough about avocados. Okay.
More than enough about avocados.
Indeed. Yes. They drive us crazy because, first of all, availability is very poor. I feel like making people sign a waiver or something when they buy an avocado. You do understand it could be 5 to 10 years before this plant flowers and fruits. And in the interim, it might freeze back. But other than that, they're great to grow here.
Okay. Next topic is water plants. Ooh, water plants. So this would be plants that are planted on the edge of a pond or are in a tub with water or something like that, right?
Yes. In the business, we call them aquatic plants, water plants. You have a water feature, a pond, a barrel, or something like that.
Yeah. I bought a bunch of water plants in the summer. Now they're all dying. Do I need to replace them every year? One of them is a hibiscus. It looks like it's dying. Hibiscus? That they don't, they're not water plants. Hibiscus?
Yeah, we'll come back to that. Yes, there are some hibiscus that are, well, I'll give you the best example. We'll start with this one. The marshmallow.
Oh, that's a hibiscus. I didn't realize it was a hibiscus.
Yes, it's a mallow that grows in a marsh. Many, many water plants are actually, many of the species of hibiscus, particularly those grown in the southeastern United States that are native there. There's one native to Texas as well. They grow in standing water or on the edge of a stream or in a pond or whatever. So there are, in fact, hibiscus that can be submerged or partially submerged. Backing up, aquatic plants or water plants are sold at many garden centers. I sell them. And we have two basic types, the ones that need to be in the water, submerged, like water lilies, lotus, things like that. There's also another category of what we call floaters. We should come up with another term. Floaters, which are used to either grow on the surface of the pond, like pondweed or duckweed, whether you want it or not, it's likely to show up at some point. Or the ones that you adhere somehow down to the bottom of the pond, let it grow up through the water, like parrot's feather and some of the others. Those are oxygenators. Those help to create oxygen in the water for fish and other organisms that are living down there. Then there are the marginals. And the marginals are the ones that live on the margin, as the name suggests, of your water feature, your bog, your pond, or your stream. They can be submerged or not. They can be submerged at times and not submerged at times. And many of your familiar aquatic plants from nurseries are in that category. It includes horsetail, includes papyrus. It does include these deciduous hibiscus. First two that I mentioned there are actually evergreen, but most of the things that we sell you for water gardens, for water features, are actually deciduous. Water lilies, for example, are all losing their leaves and going dormant now. They aren't dying, they're just going dormant. So they're truly deciduous. There are two categories of water lilies, hardy and tropical. If you have a hardy water lily in your pond, fine, leave it out there. It'll disappear. I guarantee February, March, it'll pop back up on its own. Lotus, likewise, if you happen to have room for it, completely gone in the winter, comes back just fine on its own. There are tropical water lilies. So you have to know what kind you bought. And if you bought it from a garden center in Northern California, pretty good chance it's a hardy water lily. But if you ordered it from one of those really cool online water plant suppliers, you could have bought a tropical one, especially because they have a range of color that is absolutely stunning, but they're not completely hardy. So as they start to go dormant here in zone USDA zone 9, you have to pull them out, wrap them up, store them through the winter, put them back in the spring. If you bought a water lily from me, you didn't get one of those, so don't worry about it. But if you bought it online or from that kind of a vendor, you should probably figure out whether it's tropical, because those will simply rot as they go through the cold weather. But for the most part, about 90% of the things we sell you for a water feature, pond, barrel, whatever, are deciduous. So try to choose at least one plant to go in there that looks good in the winter. And here in our area, that can be a papyrus. Some of them freeze back, some don't. Some of them look great. It can be a horsetail, the equisetum. There's some of the Japanese irises and other types of flag irises will have foliage through the winter. And so you'll have at least something out there to make your pond look a little less bleak.
I have a question for I've never actually had a pond. So when you do that and you go to the store and you buy a plant and it's in one of those little black all so that you can pull it out when you need to?
They put them in nursery pots that are specially designed for this purpose. They have no holes in them, but other than that, they look just like a regular nursery pot. You can lift them out. And in fact, part of your process of owning any kind of a pond or water feature is going to be every year or 2 years, every year is best, going in, draining it out, cleaning it out, trimming off the parts of, say, the water lily that are trying to grow over the side of the pot and down into the bottom of your little water pond feature. Keep them from doing that. Otherwise, you'll get what I have, which is a water feature that is comprised of one large plant. And this has happened. You let
it root into the bottom.
I let things root into the bottom. And I've actually done this. I actually really like water features like this. And I just have them fill with water, which then drains on to nearby plants that benefit from that. So they're just part of my landscape. I have two that are each completely filled with a very large papyrus plant. Papyrus is the big dramatic palm looking thing from, you know, they grew along the Nile. There are giant ones, there are small ones, and they will root over the side of a pot very quickly and into the muck that always forms on the bottom of whatever you've made your pond out of. And they will slowly fill up the entire thing. And I looked at that when it was happening about 3 years in on one of them and thought, that's actually a really cool looking feature. This giant plant, it makes incredible wildlife habitat. I always see dragonflies over that because papyrus is perfect for them to rest on. And there's frogs in there. We've had turtles show up in these ponds, and they're just sort of a freestanding ecosystem of their own, comprised of one plant in a livestock trough. If you want something more interesting, I would suggest you pull that out every year or two, cut off most of it, stick one part of it back in the pot, put it back in, and then have your other plants in there with it. But be aware that many water plants will spread to grow into the stuff that accumulates on the bottom of the pond. And eventually you'll have, instead of a pond, you'll have a bog. And then after you have a bog, you have a meadow. You can go through the process of eutrophication right there in your backyard. It may not be what you had in mind initially. The other thing really important to remember with any water feature is that you might get mosquitoes. And so you monitor for that. I have established populations of mosquito fish that I got from the mosquito abatement district. They go through the winter just fine. They're perfectly cold hardy. So I haven't had to worry about that. But I check each spring to make sure that they're still there. They are. They can live in as little as 3 inches of water. If you happen to get the mosquito district to come out, as they will do, fightthebite.net is how you get them to bring you mosquito fish. If they decide in your case that guppies are more appropriate than mosquito fish, they don't go through the winter. So you'd have to replace them each year. But mosquito fish are incredibly hardy. And if you don't have that option, there are organic, simple, safe ways to manage mosquitoes as well. Little BT product rings that you just throw in the water every so often that take care of it. But don't let your pond or water feature become a problem with respect to mosquitoes. Just monitor for that.
You said you'd come back to this hibiscus that was a marshmallow.
That's the best known one, but there's many other deciduous hibiscus that can stand in water. Hibiscus coccineus, which has got a red flower and is real pretty. Texas star is the common name on that one. You can tell that it's from the southeastern United States. They grow up from the ground. These are like the Southern Bell and Dixie Bell hibiscus that nurseries are selling like crazy now. They're hardy all the way up into like USDA zone, I don't know, 5 or 6. They're completely cold hardy. And they can be out in the ground, just in your garden, or they can be standing in water. And many of them have flowers that are stunning. I mean, dinner plate size flowers, and a bunch of breeding is going on these to get smaller versions, as usual in the nursery industry. The regular hibiscus moschitos is a 6-foot plant with a 6-foot spread. So that's a big thing. Big flowers for about a 2-month period in the midsummer. And then it turns yellow in the fall, goes completely to the ground. You cut it off completely at ground level. You don't have to try and save anything. You don't have to worry about frost tenderness on this plant whatsoever. And then, so come around April, the water or the soil warms up and it pops back up again. The thing is, you have to remember where it is and give this plant about 4 foot of spread, room for about 4 foot of spread, or even as much as 5 or 6 feet.
But as I said,
there's some dwarf types coming up. And these are, there's three or four species of hibiscus that readily grow standing in water and flower beautifully midsummer with these very showy flowers, just like the tropical hibiscus, not in that same color range, mostly red, pink, or white, but giant blooms. And then they just go completely dormant in the winter. So they can be a very showy part of not just your water feature, but your landscape as well. Just being aware that they're completely deciduous. You cut them completely down to the ground. The roots are hardy, the crown is hardy, the top goes down completely.
I was wondering about, I don't know, when do plants bloom out in the spring? So if I was deciding to create a water garden, when would I be planting it? I mean, it's brand new. There's nothing there.
Yeah, for nurseries, they're a summer product category because they push up in April. Obviously, most of us have little ponds and things with plants in them right on through the winter. Not much going on over there at the moment, except a couple of papyrus and some things like that. But they don't, the ones we've been talking about, don't really push out till April or even May. And so it's a, and summer is a really great time to do a water feature. There's a lot of wildlife that would absolutely love it if you would have a little barrel or something out there with water in it. Jays and mockingbirds love my water features. I use livestock troughs, which you can get at any feed store. And they, you know, you've seen jays and mockingbirds, they have big old claws. They need something large to grab onto. Well, the side of one of those is perfect for them. And so they make use of them, especially, by the way, if you put a couple of concrete blocks in there so they can jump from the edge onto something right more or less in the water, it's fun to watch. They will do that. They'll make use of it. So keep in mind that wildlife is going to come in and try to get in there. So plan for it. But you'll find that not much is going on in there until about April or May, to answer your question. And then in the summer, you know, all kinds of lush growth in there and dragonflies and all kinds of things going on. So it doesn't have to be, it's not, by the way, it's not a really high water thing once you fill it. You just have to keep it topped off. I have a drip line going into each of my water troughs that just fills them up while it's watering the other things that are on that same line. And if they overflow, I made sure that they were in a place where the nearby bamboo or maple trees would benefit from the overflow. So it is a good idea to overflow them now and then to keep the algae down. We can talk more about that in the summer as we get closer to water plant season. Good idea to overflow them now and then. Good to have something shading the surface of the pond in the hot weather. So either plants that cast shade on it or plants that grow over the surface. It's important to bring them more or less into balance, is a term you're going to run into a lot on pond websites. That's easy to do. And this doesn't have to become a, you know, a stinky project that nobody keeps an eye on. You just have to choose your plants carefully and be aware that 90% of them are deciduous. Getting back to the original question.
And okay, I said I didn't have a water feature, but I actually had a barrel at one point 20 years ago. I encourage people who are doing this to put a stick in that goes out of the water and up to the edge.
Are you trying to save the mice again?
I'm trying to save the mice.
Okay. Yeah, put a ladder for the mice.
Yeah. So that they can get out if they fall in and they're swimming like crazy and they can't get out.
Yes. Be thoughtful to the rodents on your property. Now, if it's a rat, totally different question.
Okay. Don, you sent me a picture. Oh, thank you. It is gorgeous. Is it glorious? It says Salvia gesnerifolia mole poblano. Wait a minute. Mole poblano. That's
food.
Mexican food, isn't it?
All right. Correct. Quick correction. It's gesneriflora, not gesnerifolia. We ask the question of each other as we get into November, December, when we're talking about what to talk about on the air. What blooms in December? What blooms in January? Well, I have to mention this one. And if you're in the coastal areas or Southern California, this will be a monster plant. I planted this Salvia gesneriflora. Tells you that the flower looks like something in the gesneriad group. This Salvia ornamental sage quickly grew to 8 by 8 feet. Okay. And it showed no sign of blooming. I thought, when is this going to flower? This is 2 years ago. And finally, it gets up about 8 feet and it's sprawling all over the plants nearby. And the flower buds started coming out in October, November. And I took pictures of this all winter long. Brilliant. I don't even know how to describe that red. Is it orange red?
Cardinal red.
Cardinal red. Okay, there we go. And I have a picture that I'll probably use as the picture with the show description at kdrt.org when you go to the Davis Garden show there. It'll be on there, and it bloomed December, January, February, and into March. And it has this amazing, vivid orange red, all right, cardinal red flower in the wintertime. So if you're listening in USDA zones 8, 7, 6, I don't think this is going to be hardy for you, but I'm not absolutely sure, because when I went to look this one up, it comes from Mexico, but the Sierra Madre, 7,500 to 10,000 foot elevation. So
that's got to be cold.
Yeah. I just don't know what it does in the winter and in those climates, you know, under snow or things like that, but should be able to go down to pretty low temperatures. That's for sure. Salvia gesnera flora. This particular cultivar is Mole Poblano. I happen to get it from Emerisa Gardens up in Santa Rosa. So if you're in that area, they do sell to the public, but it's something that I bought from them a couple of years ago in a little 4-inch pot. And I plant all these salvias because I'm curious how they do. And most of them, you know, 3 foot, 4 foot, 5 foot, maybe at the most. And I give them enough space that that's going to be suitable. I wasn't planning on an 8x8 shrub, but fortunately I didn't prune it back at all. And it gave me these amazing blooms all winter long. And I can tell you, when you have a bright red tubular flower, December, January, February, you know what's all over that flower.
Oh, those hummingbirds just love it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. So I mean, I still have the autumn sage blooming in my yard.
They will. The autumn sage is a good term for Salvia greggii, Salvia microphylla, Salvia jamesoni, which are the hybrids between those two and a couple other species. They bloom heavily in the autumn, but they also continue to bloom through the winter, actually pretty much year round. So that's a great group for drawing hummingbirds and the big Xylocopa carpenter bees. All these salvias are very attractive to the bigger bees as well as to the hummingbirds. Most of them are either spring, summer, fall blooming. Some are more or less year round. This one, midwinter bloom. So if you're living in a place where you got room for a giant salvia, Salvia gesnera flora, I don't have a common name for it, but the cultivar in particular that really stood out, Mole Poblano.
So I want this plant, but now I have very little sun in my yard. If I were to take this and plant it out with the xylosma, it'll be shaded from the south, but would it grow? Would it flower?
Yeah, it'll grow up through the xylosma. It'll poke out and give you red flowers, so it'll look like your xylosma is blooming. Yeah, I mean, people with shade who want color have to do two things. One is to prune things out to get more sunlight in for the young plant. So a little thinning when you plant the plant, so the xylosma isn't completely overhanging the existing plant. That's helpful to the young plant to get it started. Then you have to monitor and do a little bit of pruning so that the plant can get up and get at least as much sunlight as possible. But this will grow, push through, bloom. I think it's a good one for you to experiment with. The only thing is, I'm going to have to take some cuttings because I don't think they have it in production in December. So,
okay, well, I guess I'll have to put that on my calendar for next spring to plant this thing.
Salvia gesnera flora. Mole Poblano. And there's other varieties of gesnera flora, but they have fuzzy leaves that are kind of cool. Big background plant is, I guess, the key thing to take away from this.
Okay, so you order things 6 months ahead like you do. I have in front of me a little document that you showed me called the Winter Veg Order in early December.
Okay, that's a week-to-week thing. That's what I'm ordering at any given time. Yes, vegetable orders go week to week. And that was actually just an example to send you to show you what people are still bringing in at garden centers for you to plant right now in your vegetable garden. Just read down the column on the left real quick.
Arugula, beet, broccoli, cabbage, celery, kale, lettuce, peas, radicchio, spinach, and Swiss chard.
So notice
and a bunch of different varieties of those.
Notice the focus is primarily on leafy greens, things where you're just harvesting leaves or a part of the plant. I've stopped bringing in cauliflower, for example, because the plant needs a period to get going before it's going to initiate the flower buds that you're eating. And it's kind of too late for that, in my opinion, for cauliflower. Cabbage, I used to say that it needed to get going in September, October, but there's these new varieties of cabbage. Fast Vantage is one of them that I think I ordered. You can plant that anytime, and it will start to head up in February, March. They'll just be, the later you plant it, the smaller the heads will be, but they're still perfectly good cabbage. So there are some cabbages you can plant late. Broccoli is an interesting one. I don't like to stock the big-headed broccoli as you get later in the season because it's like cauliflower. It needs a good running start before it'll form that big old head that you're buying. But there's lots of branching and sprouting broccolis and home garden varieties that you get one, let's say, 4-inch head, then a bunch of side shoots. Those are great because you can plant them pretty much anytime. And the leafy things, kale, lettuce. You notice beets are on there, by the way?
Yeah,
beets are, you know, many people are growing beets for the beet, but a whole lot of people are growing beets just for the greens. And so you can, selling 6 packs of root vegetables is something that I, as a retailer, always struggled with. It's really a reasonable thing to do. I have a grower that has 6 packs of carrots, which works okay. I have one that has 6 packs of radishes. What? Well, that's radishes, what we say.
All they need to do is throw some seeds out there. You don't even have to look at them.
There are many people who will never plant things from seed, period. They just don't have good results. So 6 packs are fine. It's a rather pricey way to get a radish, but sure, I don't do them. But the carrots, all right. For carrots in 6 packs, just out of curiosity, when I'm bringing these things in to sell them, I take them home and plant them to see what happens because I don't want to be selling you things that aren't going to work. So I've taken these 6 packs of carrots where there's 2 or 3 seedlings right in each little cell. And I plant them out just as I imagine my customer is doing. Take it out of the cell, trim up the roots a little bit, put it right in. Don't even thin them out. Just plant them one whole unit like that and see how it goes. And they grow great. Everything is fine. And when it comes time to harvest, let's say late February, March, even April, I poke around there and I pull them out and it works. This is the key. Yes, it does work. You will not have nice, straight Bugs Bunny type carrots. You'll have curled up, fascinating, fun to look at carrots, but they'll get full size. They'll just be all wrapped around each other and you can tease them apart and they're perfectly good. So yes, carrots from 6 packs do work. I haven't tried radishes. Maybe I'll try that at some point. The beets do work. What mainly people are growing them for when they buy them now is they're just putting them in their garden as if they were kale or chard, and they're just cutting the leaves and using the beet greens, which is fine. And then you can keep doing that as long as you don't take off too many of the leaves during the course of the winter. And you let it kind of grow out as we get into February, March, sometime mid-March, you'll probably be able to harvest a small to medium-sized beet from that plant as well. If you want big beets, because you're growing them for beets, you should plant them late August, September, early October, direct seed them, thin them out so each plant has at least 4 to 6 inches of space so that the beets don't compete with each other as they develop, and harvest the top as little as possible to give as much food as possible to the root, and then you'll get the biggest beets in, let's say, March or even early April. But if you want them for greens, beets can go right in a container with lettuce and spinach and kale and collards. Collards get kind of big for that, but all the other ones I mentioned are fine. Crowd them close together, pick leaves, go out and pick 2 or 3 leaves from each plant for your salad or your stir fry or whatever. They're great for that. So you will see beets in garden centers. You're better to grow beets from seed for the beet, but beets for greens from the 6 packs are fine.
I see a little further down on this list. The next thing is aeonium.
Oh, that's not a vegetable, but yeah, that's my grower does succulents. Aeonium are really cool. Winter blooming, late winter blooming succulents. I don't know the common name for them. I'll pull out my Western Garden book. They look like a giant hen and chick. And they stand up rather than being at ground level. My mother absolutely loved these in coastal San Diego because many of them are a little frost tender. But what they really do is they give a big aeonium, common name, no common name. So we just have to call them aeoniums. Okay. They're just on the edge of hardy here in the Sacramento Valley, just on the edge of hardy in the East Bay, interior Southern California. Anywhere zones 15 to 24, you're fine. Zone 10, you're fine. The USDA zone 10, USDA zone 9. They might get damaged in a cold winter, but generally not. And some of them make these huge round heads in winter, late winter and early spring, and then they flower, quite showy flowers in some cases, and then they go into a summer dormancy, and this is when people kill them. They go into a summer, it's not a dormancy like, you know, like we think of where a plant goes fully deciduous. These leaves start to curl a bit more. They shed older leaves. They don't need much water in that stage, and they are best in some shade. So if you have them in full sun and you're watering them in the summer, high likelihood they're going to rot. Light shade, keep them dry, they'll come through just fine. What we have found is the shade of a deciduous tree is perfect, and they give you that beautiful late winter appearance. My grower happens to do them because they're very easy to do, and succulents are still very, very, very popular. But that was an interesting segue into winter succulents, which are also available at a lot of garden centers right now. Some things are tender, aloe vera, jade plant, some of the other succulents are too tender to have out in the open. Up against the house is fine. Aeoniums are intermediate. In a normal winter here, they're fine. If we have a freeze event, this would be one plant to do either cover or bring it closer to the house if it happens to be in a container. But they can be really showy from about February to about the first part of May.
What's a juga?
Oh, also on the same list. Okay. Ajuga is a ground cover for the shade. I'm surprised you don't have it. Ajuga carpet bugle is the common name. There's a couple other common names. It's a very easy ground cover that likes to be in the shade of deciduous trees. It's one of these, it's got a pretty kind of woodsy look. And then in the spring, actually here as early as late January, it sends up these spikes of blue to purple flowers that are very pretty. Oh. Yeah, you've probably seen it. And
I didn't know that was its name.
Yeah, Ajuga. Is it another name? Carpet bugle is the only common name I know for it. And there are a bunch of new ones. The breeders have been having fun with ajuga, which is a great plant for shade gardeners. It likes to be a little dry, so it's okay for fairly low water landscapes. It doesn't like full sun, but morning sun is fine, even into the early afternoon. There are a bunch of variegated forms, some with pink margins on the foliage. There's some really big leafed ones like Catlin's Giant, which has got this big bronze foliage. And then there's a number that hug the ground. It's a very versatile ground cover for deciduous shade of deciduous trees or the high shade of a lattice or something like that. You put in too much shade, it won't grow real well, and it certainly won't bloom. But it will bloom in bright shade, and it can take morning sun as well.
All right. So, oh my goodness. We got this thing from Josh. So I'm going to let Don read it because this is called A Song of Vines.
Ah, yes. We like it when someone writes in a Shakespearean manner. So dear esteemed gardeners of the Davis Garden Show, I write to you, seekers of soil's secrets, bearers of green wisdom in a spirit of admiration and inquiry. Before me, a fence, a humble boundary facing west in full sun, has become a canvas for life's slow spiraling art. Along its narrow stone border, where a drip line whispers sustenance to thirsty roots, I planted two potato vines. One, a testament to resilience, reaches skyward, vibrant and green. The other, weary from the sun's unrelenting embrace, and perhaps my errant watering hand falters. I watch it as one might a fading star, wondering how to weave harmony. Can you wise cultivators recommend a climbing companion, one to complement the thriving potato vine and a nearby grevillea, a partner to dance with the breeze, to laugh with the sunlight, to whisper in the language of leaves? I am not wed to the potato vine. I yearn only for balance and beauty in this space. Evergreen preferred for privacy, but not required. Your counsel would be a balm to my gardener's heart. I thank you for your generous voices that inspire and guide so many of us. Yours in the embrace of nature's song, Josh, and Josh is in Davis. Thank you very much. I love the spirit of this inquiry. Okay.
And there are pictures.
Yeah, so pictures are very, very, very helpful. I should mention potato vine, Solanum jasminoides. This is the white potato vine. Once it gets going, is an exceptionally vigorous vine. We planted one to screen off a propane tank 35 years ago. And I decided 10 years ago, I didn't like the fact that it had run over the entire structure I built for it and climbed up into the nearby trees and nearby shrubs and had run along the ground and rooted 30 feet away. So I am still trying to get rid of it. So be aware that this one can spread, but it did so by my neglect. It does the same thing that certain other vines do. It sends out these ground level runners, which you can see if you're watching for them. And as they run, let's say under all the leaf debris that might have built up on your farm, they root. And then if there's a nearby shrub, vines, as Charles Darwin demonstrated, will find their way to that and wrap their way up it. And I suddenly will notice on the top of a 20-foot holly plant that's 20 feet away from where I planted this potato vine, oh, look, the holly is blooming. Oh, no, that's not the holly. That's the potato vine reaching the top of a 20-foot shrub and poking out the top. So it's a vigorous vine that does need you to keep after it. The one in your picture that looks like it's struggling, I suspect, yes, indeed, an emitter plugged at a rather crucial time. I don't know that you need to rush to replace that plant because I see two others in this photograph that'll easily cover the whole space. So the question is, what would be compatible both in vigor or perhaps in growth habit, bloom cycle, and so forth? And the two that came to mind right away were Jasminum polyanthum, sometimes sold as pink jasmine because the flower buds are pink, they open white, super fragrant, similarly vigorous, easily runs across the ground as potato vine does. So you'll need to monitor that one, but it covers in a very similar manner and it is evergreen. It comes into bloom here in the late winter and into the spring. It is powerfully fragrant, but unlike the star jasmine, it's not overwhelmingly fragrant. And one in the back corner of your yard blooming in the late winter and into the spring, I think would be a lovely addition. If this were my yard, I'd probably put in a clematis. And the reason for that is that I think they're a particularly good companion on other vines. Now, they're not evergreen. There's an evergreen one, but I wouldn't do that one. It's too vigorous. I would look for some of the deciduous ones, and I would certainly make sure they have an emitter because clematis are not, at least as they're getting established, particularly drought tolerant. I mulch them heavily. They benefit from that. And once established, they're one of the toughest plants around, as long as they get at least ordinary or adequate watering. And they give spring bloom, well, late spring to early summer bloom in the case of the Jack Manny hybrids, midsummer bloom in the case of the of some of the other hybrids. And you have these giant purple flowers with probably the best known in the clematis group, Jack Manny hybrids in particular, but there's a bunch of others, pink, white, and so forth. So they would be a burst of bloom surrounded by the elegant, ongoing, smaller flowers of the Solanum jasminoides that you already have. So jasmine and polyanthem. Notice jasmine, by the way, is part of the name of Solanum, Solanum jasminoides. Jasminoides is a very common species name for vines. It just means like a jasmine, oides, jasminoides. Not that potato vine is particularly fragrant, but the growth habit is a lot like a jasmine. So this would be compatible. It would be something that you could do anywhere in our climate zone and even into somewhat colder climate zones. It's another vine that runs up and tangles. So every so often, you're going to need to take probably hedge shears to this whole shebang all the way down and just kind of clean out the undergrowth every couple of years, perhaps. But it would be compatible. But if you wanted to get a big burst of color, wait till spring, because that's when they're typically available, and think about adding a clematis. And again, I would focus on the deciduous types. If you don't want to prune it, look for Clematis montana. That's a whole group of them that bloom on old wood, so you don't have to prune them at all. If you don't mind pruning it, the Jack Manny hybrids with the big, showy 6 and 8 inch flowers, I'm about to pull mine down completely, cut it off at ground level, pull all that tangle of stuff out of there, and let it start over next spring. So those you do prune just to keep them from getting to become a tangled mess. But there is a group that blooms very early here, February, March, Clematis montana, which have flowers that smell like vanilla and bloom on old wood. So they're a little bit different. Look up the different types of clematis. Think about the jasmine polyanthem. There's a couple other vines I could mention, but that's probably a good starting point.
I wanted to talk about this picture. It shows the very, very narrow planting strip. It's like maybe a foot. And next to it is a fairly wide, maybe an 8 foot
path.
Tile? Would that be tile or concrete? It's a surround around a swimming pool is what it is. And then there's a fence behind this. Well, in the picture, there is a grass-like thing that is going to get huge. I really would recommend that you move that thing into a corner someplace because it's going to get huge and it'll make it hard to even walk past there.
It appears that they've already kind of figured that out. It looks like what was planted here, this is unsolicited advice, but why not? This is Penicetum setaceum cuprium, the purple fountain grass, which grows fine here. Does freeze back, by the way. Mine always freeze to the ground. I'm out in the country. In town, they just get a little rough looking. So most people cut them back hard sometime midwinter. This is a plant that needs about a 4x4 area, and you don't have room for that. So this is a great time if you want to do it either now or wait till the beginning of spring to go ahead and dig that grass up and maybe move it over to a corner where it would have room to spread and you wouldn't have to prune it constantly. As you have it here, yes, as Lois is suggesting, it's going to crowd the path around the pool. So it might be better to just go ahead and find a better place for it. There are, by the way, there are grasses and grass-like plants, sedges and fescues and things that could fill in around the gravel underneath these vines that would give perhaps the look that you were thinking of initially. So look at some of the silver-leafed fescues like Beyond Blue. Look at some of the native fescues. There's some native red fescues that are really attractive forms of the red fescue that have been selected that make nice trailing, soft, lush-looking plants and a bunch of sedges that would work as well. So if you're looking for an accent perennial to put at the base of these vines, I would go ahead and move this Penicetum down to a corner where it can do whatever it wants, and then fill in with some lower growing accent plants. Some of the Dianellas are also worth looking at, or Lomandras, Dianella, Lomandra. Landscapers are using them like crazy now because they're a grass-like plant. They have variegated leaves, or they have shiny green leaves. So there's a bunch of accent perennials, is the term we use for plants with blade-like or grass-like leaves that could complement the vines and wouldn't take up as much space as the Pennisetum is doing.
My other two questions is that you said clematis, but I always thought clematis needed to have their feet in the shade and their heads in the sun. And I've this is a west-facing wall. This is going to get super hot.
No, well, first of all, the vines eventually will shade them, and they would just need to be mulched. You can plant clematis pretty much anywhere as long as you don't have the roots exposed to dry, baked soil. And so where they grow in nature, we have clematis species up in the coast range around Lake Berryessa. They're always down under a shrub, growing up on top of the shrub and flowering up on top of the shrub. That's exactly what clematis will do in this situation. It'll scramble up through. This is something you need to know if you get into them, as I have at times. I have a 35-year-old clematis jackmanni by my front door. This year, I had to take out all the sarcococca that it had been climbing on in order to get out the potato vine. Notice we've come full circle on this. So I cut all the sarcococca down. I pulled out the clematis and realized in 35 years, the root clump, which is what you're really growing with clematis, you're growing a root system, a root clump that is like an herbaceous deciduous perennial is what it is. It just happens to be a vine, was now over 3 feet across.
Wow.
And a piece of it has come up 3 feet away from, I assume, either a piece of stem or a portion of the root system. And each spring, about the end of February, 1st of March, I have to decide where that plant is going to go, because it shoots up and within a week, it's 2 feet up. And within 2 weeks, it's 3 or 4 feet up, scrambling on whatever is nearby. And you've got about 8 weeks of vigorous growth before it then goes into bloom. In the past, I just let it run all over the sarcococca. Well, I just took them out. So I looked at this mass of what was coming up, and I thought, well, I'll deal with this later in terms of what its permanent support is going to be. But I went and got a 6-foot tomato cage made out of concrete wire, put it over this 3-foot root mass, and staked it securely so I wouldn't have a north wind issue tipping it over later in the season. It quickly covered that entire tomato cage. It went up and out the top and sort of fountained back down to the ground and then put on approximately 800 blooms. It was unbelievably spectacular for about 6 to 8 weeks, and it continued to pop out blooms right on into the end of the summer. So make sure if you do a clematis anywhere that the roots will have adequate moisture as they're getting established. You can back off on that as they get bigger and more mature, but they're shaded by mulch or something. There's rock in this bed, but I would much rather see compost around a clematis if you go in that direction. Rock reflects heat. Compost helps to cool things and helps to enrich the soil and conserves moisture. So it would be better to pull away the rock a little bit and mulch around this plant or any new vine that goes in there, actually, and just be prepared for a plant that's going to be extremely vigorous the second and third year, and from that point forward. And they need to be able to scramble up onto something. So they'll scramble up onto your potato vine and your fence and burst into that glorious bloom in the summer. And again, there's a lot of hybrids out there that you can look into, but the key question is going to be, do you want to cut it back once a year, or do you not want to have to prune it at all?
So one of the things that I did when I had a clematis, which has failed 30 years ago, is I took some bird netting and I just stapled it to the fence behind the clematis. That was enough to give it a little bit of something to climb on until it could get to the top. And with this fence, there's openings up near the top, what I'm sure it could wind its way through.
It's a very lightweight vine. This is the thing. It's not like a wisteria or a grape where you need a great big support structure for it. It's a very lightweight vine that's accustomed to just leaning or hanging on to other plants. So I have one white flowered one that climbs up into my nearby blood good Japanese maple every year. There's a lot of vines where I would certainly not let that happen. In the case of the clematis, it just sort of infiltrates with the foliage of the Japanese maple and then outburst these 8-inch blossoms that are bright white. In the case of that variety, it's very pretty. I do make a point of pulling it off once a year, cutting it back to the ground, so it'll start over that process. But like peas and some other vines, this is a very lightweight thing. It's not a great big woody type of plant that needs some sort of permanent support, just something to scramble onto. Shrubs preferred.
So I'm looking at this fence, and on the other side is a neighbor's property, which looks like it has some bushes and things like that. I'm a little concerned that your potato vine is going to go right underneath that fence, right into your neighbor's yard, and become a problem with neighbors.
Well,
What do you think?
I can't really tell whether those are neighbors or a green belt or what, but you definitely will need to monitor. And this is the thing. The worst mistakes I've made on my property have all been vines. Well, roses in some cases, but vines for the most part. We can talk about the roses that are a problem. I can do a whole show on that topic. Vines that I didn't monitor carefully. That's really it. I had a customer who had 18 jasmine polyanthem around her backyard. She had a chain link fence and she wanted to cover it, so she put 18 of them around the backyard. We did two things for her back when we offered these services. One was that we would take hedge shears and shear that massive overgrown stuff back to the fence line every 2 years. And the first time we did it, I warned her, "You're going to be really mad when we get done. This is going to look terrible. You're not going to want to pay us. So I'm going to tell you now how bad this is going to look. And I guarantee in 2 to 4 weeks from after we do the pruning, it'll push out, new growth will come, and within a few weeks after that, it'll be back to normal." And she agreed. It did look terrible, but she was willing to pay us because I was right. It did come back. So that's the good news. So we did that every couple of years. And I can guarantee when we did it, we'd hit at least three or four paper wasp nests as we went through. Good thing they're not super aggressive, but be aware of that. The other thing we would do, and we'd show her this so she'd monitor as well, from the ground, potato vines and jasmine and certain other vines, these runners that I described, they're branches, they're not rhizomes, they're actual top growth. They run across the ground, right hugging the ground. And they go 10 to 12 feet in a single season. And at every node, they're rooting. There's a perennial morning glory that does the same thing. So you monitor those really carefully. And if it's on a fence, monitoring includes looking along the backside to make sure it hasn't gone under the fence into the neighbor's yard or the green belt or whatever it is that's nearby. And so you just have to make sure they don't get out of hand. And that's a once a year thing. It's kind of like bamboo. You monitor it once a year, you can keep it from getting out of hand. But if you let it go 2, 3, 4 years and they go, "Oh, I'll get to that later," I can tell you with potato vine, later will be a bigger job. Okay. Speaking from experience.
You made a recommendation, and I'm wondering about Lady Banks Rose. I mean, that
Sure.
would certainly cover that fence.
Well, a single one down at the end would be overwhelming. The only issue I have with that is that the potato vine would very quickly scramble up into the Lady Banks Rose. If you want a thicket, and I'm a big fan of thickets, if you want to drop birds, I'm a big fan of drawing birds, that would be a great combination for it. However, at some point, someone is going to be swearing at you as they have to take the hedge shears to it. So Lady Banks would be a possibility, but it's a woody plant that arches and gets huge, as we have many times
Huge.
described on the air, and the potato vine would happily infiltrate into that. So that seems like it might be creating a monster, and I've done enough of that to kind of warn people away from it. Unless you like that kind of thing, we'll just do a whole show sometime on how to make thickets and draw wildlife to your garden.
I
There
like it.
you go.
Okay, we always end the show with a quote, and today the quote is, "A gardener plants to benefit another generation."
I like that one. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.